Hi, everybody. My name is John Scott, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, John!
I was watching that young lady do this morning. This is time for applause. I want to thank you folks for inviting me to this very special occasion, your birthday. And I got a group that I call a home group, just almost as crazy as you folks. Bunch of sick and retarded people there, and none of you that wouldn't fit right in. So come see us anytime you want to. It's a recovery group in Billings, and they are a strange assortment of wonderful and wacky people. So if you feel like this group is doing it wrong, come over to our group and we'll straighten out. I want to thank Chad and the committee for asking me to show up here on this momentous occasion. I want to thank Mike and Jay for being prompt and meeting me at the airport. Well, they kind of met me at the airport, but anyway, they were there. I didn't have to walk, so that was good. And I've just had a great time. All kidding aside, this is the type of AA that I crave. It's a little phrase in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous on the page 164. It says that God will show us how to create a fellowship that we crave, and boy, this is what I always wanted. I didn't know it. I'm the kind of guy who always knows what I want, but what I really want is not what I want. And when I get what I really, really want, it's not what I really wanted. And people would say, no, you don't want that. You want this over here. And I'd say, no, that's not what I want over there. I want this here. And I'd get this here. And that this here just got me weirder and weirder and weirder. And finally, I started doing what I didn't want to do, and I started getting everything I ever really wanted. And I didn't know that's what I wanted until I got here. And that's an amazing thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm the kind of guy who knows. I don't know if there's anybody else in here who knows, but I know. I know things that are not true, and I will believe them until I die from it. I know that things are true, even though everybody all around me is saying, no, that's not the way to do it. And I go, yeah, it is. That's exactly the way I should do it. And that's how I got here, doing it exactly the way I thought I should do it every chance I got. And I don't want you to think I'm slow, but I'm a little slow. I'm finally come to the conclusion after being here for quite some time. It's dawning on me. I'm not too swift. And it took me a year and a half of sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one day I woke up and I thought, my God, I'm an alcoholic. Well, don't call me lightning for nothing, you know. I've been sober since December 19th, 1982. And so that's... And for that, I'm awful grateful, and so are a whole bunch of other people. And this is not what I wanted to do. I didn't want to get sober. I mean, why would you want to get sober? I mean, really. I mean, when I was out there drinking, I mean, that was kind of, I'd get relaxed. You know, you have a few drinks, and you have a kind of a miserable day, and you're tense and nervous and upset, and you go in there and you have a few drinks, and it's just kind of come over you, you know, and you can kind of relax and begin to talk about things you absolutely have no clue in the world what you're talking about. It's okay. I had a brand new banker one time, and we got in an argument one night. He was at the Northern Hotel. I drank basically in two places. I drank in the Northern Hotel or the Keg Bar. The Northern Hotel was where all the ranchers and farmers and realtors and business people went and drank, kind of an upper class place. And I drank at the Keg Bar, where all the bikers and the wannabe has-beens and the ne'er-do-wells all drank. And I was comfortable at either place. It didn't matter. Usually I'd start out at the Northern, and then they'd kick me out of there, and I'd end up at the Keg. I can't tell you how much I, you know, whether I drink at one place or the other any more than the other. I mean, I don't know, because most of my stories, I was blacked out most of the time, so most of my story is hearsay. I'm married to the same wife that I was married to when I was drinking. We got to where we hated each other a lot. Not when I first found her. When I first found her, I thought she was it. And I was playing in a rock and roll band then at the time. A few years earlier, I was working for my dad on the ranch, and all of a sudden I thought I needed a little change. So I went from being a redneck cowboy in the early 60s to a long-haired, maggot-infested hippie in the late 70s. You know, and I'm a chameleon. You know, what do you want to see? And I'll be it. You know, it doesn't matter. And anyway, I got in this rock and roll band, and I was a legend in my own mind for quite some time. And we played all over the world and various other places. You know, mostly around Billings. I don't have no flashy story. I really don't. I just drank, and I didn't get in a lot of trouble. I mean, every once in a while, I'd be forced into hitting a cop or something, get thrown in jail for a little bit. But that, now, there's no flash, really, to tell you the truth. At first, my drinking career was fantastic. I mean, I just had a blast, you know. My wife, who was a black belt Al-Anon, and she thought that she was getting a pretty good deal when she met me, because I was playing in this rock and roll band, and I didn't drink then. I just did as many drugs as I could, but I never drank. And I remember, she was kind of proud of the fact that I didn't drink, but after 4 years of starving to death, I finally decided to go back to work in the agriculture, and I cut my hair, started drinking, started catching hippies and cutting their hair, you know, I just went back to another way of life, and it's easy for me to do that. I can do that without almost thinking. I mean, it just seems like the thing to do. You know, I got this thing that I work with all the time, and it talks to me in the night, you know, whenever I'm trying to sleep, and it'll tell me about how they're screwing me over again, and I'll figure out a new way to go. Like I said, I loved her dearly. I really did, and I found myself slowly, over a period of time, taking that beautiful woman and just almost destroying her. We ended up with several kids, and I ended up working for my dad on the ranch, it was not a small place. We had a pretty good size outfit. My job, it was in the morning, I'd step outside of my house and I'd go over to my helicopter and I'd get in it and I'd fly to work. And I'd make sure that there's about 75 alcoholics just like me working as hard as they could. And the reason I hired alcoholics is you don't want to hire Al-Anons that make you look bad. You know, and I would at night I'd have them all over at my house and we'd be drinking, and I don't need to tell you, not much got done. It was a great place to work, but nobody worked. We finally went broke in that place, and that was in the 70s, sold my helicopter and fired all my alkies, and one thing led to another, and I just got to where I drank a lot because the job load was over, you know. The reason I drank for the longest time is because I had this great big heavy job load that I had, and of course I drank because of her. If you had a woman like I did, you'd drink too, you know. During the late 70s, I just got to drinking a lot. I drank every day. I drank as much as I could every day, and I wasn't always drunk, but if I wasn't drunk, I'd been drinking, you know. And I didn't trust anybody that didn't drink. You can't trust them, you know. How can you trust somebody who don't drink? And they didn't have any fun. And I wasn't worried about being an alcoholic, but one of the things that really bothered me is my wife wouldn't drink like I drank. And we'd have her have, you know, two or three drinks, and she'd get like two down, and she'd say, "Well, no, thank you. I'm starting to feel it." Of course you're starting to feel it. That's what you're supposed to do. You have a couple more drinks, and you'll get past that feeling, whatever you feel, and you'll get to what I feel. And she just wouldn't do it, you know. And she'd sit there, and she'd get these drinks with the umbrellas in them, you know, and all the weird names and the weird colors, and she'd sit there and she'd do that, and she'd talk. Or she'd sit there and she'd do that, and she'd talk. I mean, that's alcohol abuse. You never would touch it, you know. My deal was, I walk in the bar, and they know what my deal was. It's two at a time and keep them coming, and they knew what two at a time was, you know. And I'd just sit down there, they'd set two drinks up, and if she was there, they'd ask her what she wanted, and she'd go, "Well, I, and it's just like a major decision for her to figure out what she's going to drink. I'd have to, you know, I'd drink my two down, and she's still talking and letting her ice melt in hers, and I'd have to sit there and drink hers so I didn't look so bad because I ordered another set. She never did do it good. She never could learn how to drink, and I was always kind of embarrassed by her attitude. She never did catch it. When I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a sponsor named Richard, and Richard, he explained to me about the nature of the illness of alcoholism, and he'd point me to the doctor's opinion in the big book, and he talked about this allergy to alcohol that we have, and I couldn't get it. I couldn't get it, you know. And I'm allergic to things. I'm allergic to apples, bananas, cherries, and avocados. And by the way, I want to thank the committee for the fruit basket. When I take a bite out of an apple, I swell up, my chest swells up, my throat swells shut, and I can't breathe. And I never had a reaction like that when I drank alcohol. When I drank alcohol, I just got thirsty. I just wanted more. I mean, it just tasted like another drink. In the book, it talks about a craving for alcohol. I never had a craving for alcohol, not once. You know, I'd go into the town every once in a while, go to the Northern Hotel, and, you know, heck, it might be 8:30 in the morning, but I wasn't craving. I was just thirsty. And I'd go in there, and they'd give me two at a time, and they kept them coming until, you know, the bar closed. And how the Northern Hotel would close is at 12:30, 1 o'clock, they would shut down. Well, the bars closed in Montana at 2 o'clock. So they would just shut down. And you could sit there and drink all you wanted to. Well, sometimes I'd find myself alone drinking, and everybody else is gone. And they'd just leave all the drinks on the table that everybody else had. And I would just, well, I mean, it's free booze. I mean, you can't turn that down. So I'd go around, and I'd just mix all these drinks that everybody had left, and shoot, I'd finish it off, you know. And somebody told me once that wasn't really social drinking, but I felt like it was a good deal for me. I thought it was like a blue light special, and I did that a lot. The thing is that it finally got to where I couldn't do it anymore. I mean, I got to where my life was really getting turned upside down, and I had this imaginary thing going on. I always thought I was something special. I really did. I thought that I had some things going for me that other people didn't. I had this gray matter, my secret weapon between my ears, and one of the things that I kind of knew that nobody else really knew was that I was just a hair above the average bear. I mean, I was just a little bit sharper than most, because I was somebody, you know. I mean, I had people fly me to Minneapolis and to Chicago, and bankers and lawyers, and feed me and wine me and dine me and that kind of stuff, I just had this illusion about who and what I was, and the truth of the matter is, it's all a lie. I believe lies. I love lies. You give me a guy who'll tell me the truth, or a crook, I'll believe the crook every time. You know why? Because I like him. Honest guy I can't hardly stand because he tells me the truth. No, truth always for me was kind of like, just painful. You know, I just don't want to hear it. And I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had a lot of people tell me a lot of truths, and I didn't like it at all. The truth of the matter was I was so desperate when I finally got here that I was willing to do some things that I've never been willing to do ever before in my entire life. I said that my sobriety date was the 19th, but I got to always remember the 18th. The 18th of December, I woke up in the basement of a house that I really didn't know where I was at. I finally figured out where I was at, and me and this other guy who had been drinking for quite some time. I was a runner. I'd get drunk and I'd be gone for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. And then I'd get sober for a little bit and then I'd be gone for 2 or 3 weeks. And I mean a little bit. I'm talking about 24, 48 hours. I was never somebody who could stay sober for very long. I mean, why would you? And I ended up waking up that day and I'd lost my pickup. I had a tendency to lose my pickup every once in a while. It was stolen mostly. And I'd end up talking to this guy, and I says, you know, listen, I can't do this anymore. I mean, I'm trying to figure out how to kill my wife and kids. And I really was, because it was their fault. It was their fault my life is upside down the way it was. I mean, I'd already decided that I had to kill myself. And I was kind of like Wayne was talking about, just couldn't quite get there, you know. It just depended on what 5 minutes was. I had a mind of a newcomer, you know, what 5 minutes it is, or 2 seconds. It's like, well, I need to kill her. Well, I need to kill myself, you know, or you know, what if I go to AA and it works? Well, what if I go to AA and it don't work? You know, what happens if she stays? What happens if she leaves? You know, my mind's just flipping back and forth just all the time, and I could never. It was really hard for me to stop this thinking that I had. And sometimes it used to be in the past that when I drank, it would stop, but now it doesn't even stop anymore. And I found myself, you know, drinking as much as I could, trying to shut that thing down a little bit. And what would happen is I'd drink like a fifth of whiskey or 2/5 of whiskey, and I would just be sober. And then the next time I drink like a can or 2 beers, and then I'd be so bombed out I couldn't even function, you know. And so I had absolutely lost my control over the alcohol. Anyway, this morning we went and found my pickup, and there's a guy named Frank who'd been out at the feedlot where I worked out on the ranch, And he'd come several months earlier, about 6 months earlier, he'd come out to the ranch, and he wasn't drinking. And Frank and I drink. I mean, Frank drank like I drank. And we'd just get going, and the next thing you know, heck, it might be a week or two before we got back. And Frank said I was opinionated one night, and we argued about it all that night. And the next morning, I finally proved him wrong, you know. And I ended up that night losing my pickup, too, come to think of it. And the thing is that what happened is Frank shows up that night, 6 months before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he wouldn't drink. And he would not have a drink with me. I said, what's wrong with you, Frank? How come you're not drinking? You always drink. And he says, no, I'm just not going to have a drink. And I'm a very obnoxious drunk when I'm drinking. If you're not going to have fun with me, then I have fun with you. And so Frank's trying to get up these stairs. My bar is in the basement underneath the kitchen. And he's trying to get upstairs, and I'd just go grab him by the hind leg and drag him back down the stairs and put him on the stool, and we'd sit there and have these drinks. And well, he wasn't drinking, I was drinking. And he kept telling me he had to go. And I kept saying, well, why do you have to go? What's so important that you got to leave a nobody like John sitting here by himself, you know? And finally he told me, he says, well, John, he says, I'm going to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. I've been going for about 4 months. I said, Frank, my God, Alcoholics Anonymous, that's a... Aren't you overcorrecting just a little bit, Frank? And I says, geez, you drink just like I do. And he says, yeah, I know. I said, my God, Frank. And then I got to thinking about it, and my life is upside down. I mean, I hated my wife. I hated my job. I hated everything. And I said to Frank, I says, Frank, maybe I'll go to that meeting with you. He says, hell no. He says, you can't come to a meeting with me. I said, why not, Frank? He said, because Alcoholics Anonymous is for people who have quit drinking, and you're still drinking, obviously. When you want to quit, come see me. He says, come see me tomorrow. He says, I'll take you to a meeting tomorrow, but I'm not going to take you one tonight. And I can remember waking up that next morning going, oh, my God, you know what I almost did? I almost went to A&A last night. You know, geez, this is getting freaky. I'm going to have to quit this stuff. I'm going to have to really start paying attention to what's going on here. So anyway, 6 months later, we're driving down the road, me and this other guy that I've been drinking with, and I told him, I says, we need to go see Frank. Frank's going to that Alcoholics Anonymous. And see, I know things. It's not true, and I believe them. And I know that Alcoholics Anonymous is about how you learn how to drink sociably. So I was under the impression that that's what we was going to learn. We was going to learn how to go in there and just, you know, drink like my wife drank. You know, have one or two drinks and then leave. I was badly mistaken when I got here. You guys had other plans. But the thing was is that I finally found Frank. He was working over at a feed store. And he was glad to see me. He was just so tickled. He had these 20 questions, these AA 20 questions. And he handed them to me, and this other guy is with, and says, here, read these. And we was reading them, and we was asking Frank if he'd take us to a meeting. And it was 8 o'clock in the morning. We'd already gone out and got us a case of beer because we were thirsty. Whenever I drink a lot like that, I get thirsty, and the next morning I get nervous, and I need something to calm me down a little bit. And I'd already had one or two beers, and Frank says, no, I won't take you to a meeting. I said, well, come on, Frank, when can we go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? He says, when you quit drinking. He says, you've not quit drinking yet. And says, as soon as you quit drinking, I'll be glad to take you. He says, drink all you want today. Drink until the sun goes down. He says, drink until midnight. He says, but, you know, don't drink tomorrow, and I'll take you to a meeting. And you know, he says, in the meantime, look at these 20 questions. So, me and this other guy, we decided to go to the Keg Bar. You know, it's 8:15 in the morning. And I knew another thing that wasn't true. I knew that with a name like Alcoholics Anonymous, your membership is dropping really bad. It has to be. I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous, come on. And then you guys was somehow getting these new guys to come in and getting them to pay $50, $25, $50, $100 a month for membership. And the way you suckered these dummies in there is you had this test that nobody could pass. It's 20 questions. So five of us guys in the Keg Bar at 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning are trying to pass this test. And we're, you know, check one off, you may be. Check two off, you probably are. Check three off, you're in bad trouble. Four, you're done. You know, well, heck, I'm getting like 18, 19 of these things checked off, you know. And everybody else does too. And, you know, it's obvious. It's a trap. It's a stinking trap. My wife was working at a bank at the time because it was in the middle of a recession in Billings, Montana. I mean, nobody could get a job anywhere. And one of the times, she'd move out, she'd move in, she'd move out, she'd move in, and all this was going on because we'd hate each other for 5 seconds, and all of a sudden we'd fall in love again and didn't have to bring her back. And then she'd leave, and then I'd have to go find her, or I'd leave, and she'd have to come find me. We was like, we hated each other, but we couldn't turn loose, you know what I mean? And we just couldn't turn loose of each other, but we hated each other. And the more we hated each other, the more we couldn't turn loose. And the more we tried to help each other, the worse we got. And so finally, one of the times she moved to town, and she said she was going to get a job. I laughed. I said, what the hell, you're going to get a job? How can you get a job? We have this recession going on in Billings. All my friends at the Keg Bar, ain't none of them have a job. Been looking for years. I didn't know I was married to a pre-Al-Anon. She went in there and she found 3 jobs in a half an afternoon and was working all 3 of them. And one of them was at a bank. And the bank was having a party that night, and the night of the 18th. And I called her and I says, I'm not going to make it to the party. Because she would not go anywhere with me drinking after some time. Because I'm the kind of guy to get up on the bars and, you know, pour drinks as I'm walking down over your drinks. I got kicked out of those places. It's one thing to get kicked out of the Northern, it's another thing to get kicked out of the Keg. And I just got, it didn't matter. It seems like they just didn't like me sometimes. And I had to, I'd called her up and I told her, I said, Cindy, I'm not going to make it to your Christmas party. I just can't make it. I'm drinking. But I want you to know one thing. I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous tomorrow. Oh, she was elated. She went, I drank all that day, the 18th. I drank as much as I could. And I never even got drunk. I drank all day long, and I couldn't even get drunk. And I would sit over there in the corner, and I would cry. I'd cry because I was so lonely, because nobody loved me, because nobody cared about me. And I had such deep feelings for other people, and I just bawled. And then you'd come over and try to console me, and I'd want to fight you, because you're one of those people. You're else against me or for me. You're always against me or for me, one or the other. And it didn't matter. If you was really for me, you wasn't for me enough, because if you was, you'd do this or whatever it was. So you was always against me. Everybody's against me. So I just bawl. And the next morning, I woke up and for some reason, that was on the 19th, and I've never had another drink since. And Frank called, says, I want you to come in a little early. Says, go to have a supper with me and a guy named Richard. And he says, and if you would, you come on in early and we'll sit down and we'll visit a little bit. Well, we went over to this restaurant, and I was not hungry. Fact is, when I drank like I drank, I didn't want to eat for days and days after I quit drinking. I didn't want to eat when I was drinking, you know. And I used to tell people I was anorexic when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and look what it's done for me now, you know, because I only weighed about 160 pounds at the time. I know it's hard to believe, but I was kind of dented up. And I found myself going over there to this restaurant, and Richard and Frank were there, and they would, order the steak, it's really good. And they ordered me a steak, and they ate it, you know, because I wasn't hungry. And I remember Richard asking me some questions. And he told me a little bit about his life and how he had worked for General Motors and how he had made a lot of money over the years. And then he had been struck with this disease called alcoholism. And he'd been fired, got sober for 5 years, went back out and drank again, and now he's sober again for 5 years. And he wore a 3-piece suit, wingtip shoes, and just stood just like this because he had bad back, and smoked cigarettes just like this constantly, you know, just a little bit intense. He asked me, he says, do you believe that you're responsible for your own actions? Now, I know that this is an elite group of Alcoholics Anonymous because I've been trying to get into it for over 6 months, and I keep getting turned down. And my mind is just wheeling and rolling. And I said, yes. And he says, good. He says, maybe now you'll start acting like you're responsible for your own actions. And I thought, my God, he's been talking to Cindy. I knew he had, you know, and at least Richard had, or Frank had been talking to Cindy, because Frank and Cindy were, later on, whenever I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, Frank had always rat on me every chance he got, and usually through Cindy. I told him yes, and he says, good, maybe you'll start acting like it. And I didn't know at the time, but Alcoholics Anonymous was already starting to get my mind set to where I could do things that I never dreamed possible. I found myself going to that meeting that night. I don't remember much that was said. I remember that there's another new girl there, and I've never seen her since. I also remember that there's people laughing and scratching and having a great time with each other. They were just having a ball. And I was really kind of feeling sorry for myself because they were all paid counselors, obviously. You know, because if they was alcoholics like I was an alcoholic, they wouldn't be laughing and having a good time. And that night there was a guy who said that he would be my sponsor. And my thoughts was, well, he must be going to pay that $50 for the next few months and kind of get me started here or something like that. I didn't know what a sponsor was. And he says, I'll tell you what you do. He says, when I go home tonight, he says, I want you to go home with me. And so I did. And he talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous for several hours until 2 o'clock in the morning when the bars closed. And then he said, it's time for you to go home now. So I went home. And in the morning, he called me back up again and says, come on in. And he had an auction. And I went in there and stayed there until about 11 o'clock. And then two guys from the group showed up. And then they took me out to eat at lunch. And they all the time were talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm really kind of nervous about this time. So they fixed up this concoction of K-roll syrup and honey and orange juice and a few vitamins and put it in a blender and said, drink this, it'll make you feel better. It didn't make me feel better, but it tasted so bad, I just told them, I feel better, I really do. And they kept trying to push this down for days, and I kept telling them, I feel better, but they wouldn't go for it. They wanted me to drink it, and I hate orange juice to this day. But what happened is, little by little, I'd have another bunch of guys get me later on in that afternoon, and then they would take me to the meeting that night, and then this guy who was my sponsor, he would take me home until 2 o'clock, and at 2 o'clock, I'd go home, and then the next morning, I'd show up at his place. And they started relaying me for 2 or 3 weeks, and I didn't drink. And here's a guy who was knocking out a fifth and a half of whiskey every day with a, you know, 2, 3, 6 packs of beer. And I just went from that to zip to nothing. And life is not wonderful when that happens. it just makes you a little tense. And in the meantime, my sponsor starts calling me in the middle of the night saying, they're getting close. They're in my closet. Get in here. I need some help now. Who are they? I don't know, but they're getting close. You know, I'm like, you know, I may be new, but I'm not stupid, you know. And then he'd call me back up and say, they're outside. They're in the car. They're going to come in here any minute. Get in here. Click, you know, and I'd call up other people that he was sponsoring at the time. I'd say, Jesus, have you talked to Johnny today? Yeah, he's crazy as hell. You know, you know, it's like, what should I do? I don't know. I'm not going over to me either. You know, and then you hang up the phone. The phone would ring. It's Johnny. It's a, who you been talking to? I was talking to Joey. Joey's just worried about you. Oh, Joey's against me too, huh? we go talk to the old timers and they say, stay away. Just keep coming to meetings, keep coming. So even though I was new, I knew that was just a little twist, isn't it? And in about 45 days, he'd gotten mad at his group and he'd gotten mad at his sponsor and he'd got a little twisted and he was gone. So I thought, well, now I get a chance to ask somebody to be my sponsor. I've been kind of eyeing this little old blonde for the last couple of days. I'd come into the meeting, I was kind of walking across the hall or the room there, and this Richard intercepted me, and he says, I'm sorry to hear about your sponsor. I said, well, yeah. He says, I'm going to be your sponsor now. I said, well, John or Richard, I'm not sure. I don't really think I want you to be my sponsor. I mean, I didn't ask or nothing. Oh, he says, it doesn't matter what you want. He says, I'm going to be your sponsor now. And he was like that. He always knew what I needed before I knew what I needed, you know. And he would just tell me things to do. And somehow I was sick enough that I would listen to this used car salesman and do what he told me to do, you know. And in a few days, I'd bought a car from him, you know, a diesel. But he really had a way about it. He made me feel like I was important. But at the same time, he made me understand that there's a whole bunch that I didn't have a clue about, you know, and he was able to kind of spoon feed me along a little bit and get me to do things that I would not do for anybody. I came in here and I had this bad attitude because I had the secret weapon because I knew a little more than most of you. I mean, I looked at the steps on the wall and the traditions. And I thought, yeah, for those people, they're probably going to need them. You know, they're a pretty sick bunch, but I'll be all right. I'll be all right. I looked at the steps and I thought, 3 weeks. 3 weeks I'll be out here. And here it is 18 years later. I'm still trying to get them. But the truth of the matter is what happened is little by little I got sour after I got sober. I mean, sobriety to me wasn't, you know, I found God in AA and everything. Sobriety was sucked. I hated sobriety. I mean, it was not what I really wanted. And at the same time, I knew that I couldn't drink because drinking scared me to death because when I drink, anything's possible. Anything. anything is possible. I mean, I could get suicidal or homicidal, and I didn't want that either. And I was really in a trap because I didn't have sobriety, and I wasn't drinking. And there used to be an old guy named Nick, and Nick used to say, you know, it'd be a shame for us to take away booze from an alcoholic and not give him something better. And I kept listening to these meetings where there's something better, and it never clicked. And, oh, I was a whiner. I would whine. I'd go up to the old timers, and I'd tell them how bad she was because she was treating me so badly, and she was. She really was. I mean, it killed most of you, I guess. But the trouble is what happened is this bunch that I was with was a bunch of vicious old timers, and they wouldn't put up with this crap. And I remember one night, there's people in this group like Gerald. Gerald was a kind of a hillbilly type of guy from Warm Springs, you know, that's the nut house in Montana. There's another guy, this guy named Nick. He was a little old guy who had been a counselor down in Denver. And there's another guy named Rotten Ralph, who was an attorney. He earned a name. I mean, he got the name right. And there's a bunch of these old guys around there, you know, that had 10, 15, 20 years. And they just wouldn't put up with much stuff. Rotten Ralph's deal was, you know, he would sit there in a meeting and he would pick on some new guy and kind of, you know, there may be a group there, but you know who he's talking to. And he would sit there and say these things that would just, you know, cut you to the bone. And then after he was through, he'd pull out a dollar out of his shirt pocket and say, now, if I have really made you mad, maybe I ought to buy you your first drink. So if anybody wants a drink, here's a dollar. You know, these are the kind of loving people I was running around with. And then there's this other guy, this Nick. And Nick says, there's no need for me to remember anybody's name around here unless they've been here for 6 months because everybody's just coming and going. He says, I'm not even going to worry about it. And I, by God, I'm going to make him remember my name. So I walked up to there one night, and I don't know if you've ever done this with an older member, but you sit there and you kind of say things in a way that you kind of get them to where they're eating out of your hand, you know, where they kind of going with you a little bit. And I started telling old Nick about this bad story of woe that I had with my terrible wife that I was still married to, even though I couldn't stand her. And I could see it in his eyes. He's starting a little compassion, you know. And there's about 8 or 9 people left in the room that night, and all of a sudden he jumps up and screams at me. He's got this real high, shrill little voice, you know. He says, so you're a goddamn alcoholic. Now what the hell are you going to do about it? You know, and it's like, you know, just people are hearing this, you know. Old man badger me, and I just, you know, I get up and I get out and I'm going to go outside. And to get outside, I got to go by this refrigerator in this hallway. And Nick has beat me to it. And he's over there and he's got this little 3-finger push right in my chest, pushing me up against this refrigerator. He says, why don't you just get the hell out of here? He says, you're wasting your time, you're wasting their time, and you're dang sure wasting my time. Just get the hell out of here. And old Nick's just right over his corner, just right over his shoulder. Here, get in there. Let me buy you your first drink. Let me buy you your first drink. I'm about a month sober, and I get outside, I push him aside, and I get outside, and I get in this car that my sponsor told me, I turn on it, you know, it's a diesel, it doesn't go anywhere. I was trying to spin this gravel out in the middle of the parking lot. I get about halfway home, just going crazy, and I'm honking the horn, and I'm beating on the dash. I got to drive 35 miles to the ranch, and it just kind of dawned on me, well, I am an alcoholic. What am I going to do about it? And one of the things that old Gerald would do, he'd sit there and he'd shake your hand. You know, he's a kind of a self-appointed greeter, and he'd come up and shake your hand, see how he's doing, and I'd tell him, terrible, hate you, hate God, hey. And he did that for a couple of weeks, and then he says, all right, that's enough. He says, John, from now on, he says, when I meet you, when I come up to you and I shake your hand and I ask you how you're doing, you're going to say, why, Gerald, I'm getting better in every way every day. Thank you very much. And I go in there, how you doing, John?
Well, Gerald, I'm getting better every day, every way. Thank you very much.
You know, I found myself a few days after the refrigerator incident, I found myself driving back to town, and I was just, you know, in my head was just, you know, just going nuts, and I got to see that stinker. And Richard, my sponsor, who insisted that, you know, I came into a meeting one time. I'm a farmer and rancher, and I had to be working on a tractor late one time, and I came in, and I was wearing my old hat, my, you know, I was greased up from one end to the other, And the deal was, I'd always sit next to him, and I came in there, and I sat down next to him. He looks at me, and he says, get the hell away from me. I said, what the hell's wrong with you? Get over there someplace. Get as far away from me as you can, because I'm afraid somebody might know you, or think I know you. And he says, by the way, after the meeting, you and me. And, oh, I hated that, because when he said after the meeting, you and me, was always a bad sign. And he explained to me, he says, you know, he says, this is the place that saved my life. He says, you need to start treating it like it might save your life. He says, you start cleaning it up to come in here. He says, because this is where people like you and I get better. And he says, if you're not interested in doing that, then don't come. Don't come. That's a little tough. You know, I kind of felt like they needed me by this point. And he explained to me right away that they didn't need me. I needed them. And he says, you have so little respect for anything. He says, let's start here. So I explained to him how I was a farmer and I couldn't do it. And I always had these reasons I can't do something. He just told me, you know, put clean pair of clothes in the car and change them when I get there in the bathroom. You know, I said, oh, well, I guess I could do that. You know, so I figured that, you know, there's got to be a reason why I can't do this, but he'd just always kill me on every idea. You know, and one of my first ideas was about going to meetings every night. He says, well, how often did you drink? I said, drink every night. Where'd you drink? At the Northern or the Keg. He says, well, this is a better deal than that. He says, here you are. I'm only asking you to go to 4 meetings a week, and we're going to get you out early. So he can get you out by 11 o'clock, I guess. So anyway, you know, the truth of the matter is I found myself driving back to the meeting one more time, and I'm thinking, well, I got to tell Gerald I'm getting better in every way, every day. Thank you very much, Gerald. And it dawned on me. I was, in spite of me. And all of a sudden, things started to change. And all of a sudden, I began to see that there were things happening here that I did not plan on. See, I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was about how do you quit drinking. And they taught me early on that Alcoholics Anonymous is about how do you start living. How do you start changing your life in order to live? And I didn't know that. I thought that it was about putting a plug in the jug and everything's going to be wonderful. And putting a plug in the jug, if you're an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic, is brutal. It's absolutely brutal. And that's why I like what you guys are doing here, because if you're going to do it, it sounds to me like it's going to take a lifetime. That's what the book says. And if it's going to be a lifetime and you're going to do it, by God, let's have a little fun doing it. You know, let's get a little excited about what's going on here. And, I mean, I've been to some places and it's just like, you know, watching paint dry around there, you know. You know, you don't want to smoke, somebody might go up in flames, you know. And it's just, I mean, but what happened is little by little, I was shown what can happen to somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife and I was getting a divorce, and my sponsor says, well, now, who's divorcing who? And I said, well, I'm divorcing her. Spent a lot of money on it, too, I might add. And she was going to cost me a lot more, too. And Richard says, well, you'll quit that right now. You don't understand. This woman's crazy. She lays in wait in closets with baseball bats when you come home in the middle of the night, you know. And he says, sure, she's crazy. She's got to be crazy. Anybody live with you for that long has got to be stinking out of her mind. And he says, I'll tell you what. He says, we don't want you two to get separated, because if you get separated, all of a sudden there'll be 4 of you. You know, and he says, if we can keep you contained, we have a shot here. So he says, what I want you to do, he says, I want you to start doing something a little different. He says, from now on, I want you to go home, and I want you to tell her how much you love her. But you're a liar, just so you know that. You're a liar. And he says, and from now on, because you're a liar, after you tell her you love her, she's not going to believe a word you say, so you've got to show her. And the way you show her is not what you're thinking. It's some other way. It's this. You pick up your underwear. You make the laundry, or you do the laundry, or you make a meal, or you do something. You do something that is not expected of you. You maybe get her flowers occasionally. You may do, you know, me, my deal, I just send her flowers all the time, not do nothing else. But the thing was, is that he was trying to show me how I could treat her better. And he told me that I needed to tell her that I love her. And I knew this is an honesty program. And right off the bat, my sponsor is making me lie. And so I ended up doing it anyway. And the reason that I ended up doing it was because he told me, he says, I'll tell you what. If you do it and you do it right, he says, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. It'll drive her crazy. And I said, oh, well, if it'll drive her crazy, I'll do it. You know. And so I remember going out there telling her that I loved her. And, of course, I just drive her nuts. And she she'd just void that right away, and then I'd do something nice for her. And I kept doing that day after day after day after day, and not much was happening until one day she came up to me and she says, "You're a dirty SOB, and here's why." And she had this little list, and she'd obviously taken my inventory. And she got down to the end, and I said, "Well, Cindy, that's really nice, but I said, you've left out a few items." And I just filled in a few more for her, and it's just like, you could just see it, there's something inside of her just went, you know, she just couldn't stand it anymore. And finally, you know, she started going to open AA meetings, and then finally she went to Al-Anon, and I wasn't changing much, but you could see it in her. She was changing a great deal. And after 2 years, my sponsor, Richard, he left. Now, if you got the secret weapon like I do, 2 years of sobriety, I mean, that's kind of like a pinnacle. I mean, you don't get much more brighter than 2 years in AA, I'll tell you. And if you're 2 years sober, I remember thinking, well, I don't need a sponsor. I mean, I'll use the group. And for the next 2 years, I dang near died in Alcoholics Anonymous using the group. There's a little phrase in the AA Comes of Age that Bill Wilson says. He says, the good is the enemy of the best. And that's what happens to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll settle for good, and I'll give up best. I'll settle for good, and I'll give up best, because the good is the enemy of the best. And I thought that I had done the deal. It was time for me to go out and carve out my empire out of the wilderness. You know, I went and bought a ranch, you know, with no visible means of support. And immediately the stock market and the wheat market and the land market and the machinery market, everything I just bought, went poof. So I sat on the verge of bankruptcy for the next 2.5-3 years. And that's exciting. And most of the time without a sponsor, because I had this, you know. And I knew. And as long as I know, I'll never learn nothing. And I ended up being suicidal at 3.5 years of sobriety. And I was worth more dead than I was alive. Now, I got a crazy mind. And I want to tell you this story, because this is probably, if you're new and you're thinking, well, I'll never get it, or if you're feeling sorry for yourself, this is how good my mind works. I'm sitting there one day, and I'd gone up to the bank. They wouldn't let us in the bank. They let us in this other place, the building that they leased across town, because they called that the Dyer Pen. That's where everybody who was going to get axed financially went. And so I was over at the Dyer Pen, and I was going up the elevator, and I was feeling sorry for myself, because they was telling me every week that next week, this week we're not going to do it, but next week we're going to foreclose on your house and your business and everything else. And that went on week after week after week after week forever. And I ended up, it dawned on me, I'm more dead than I am alive. I need to just wipe myself out. And I come down out of that building that day, and I'm thinking about going home and somehow killing myself. My wife and kids were gone. And I drove around the block, and there's this pretty girl just walked across the street. And all I thought about for the next 3 hours was this pretty girl. You know, I was boom, you know, just grabbed another gear and went on, you know. And like 3 hours later, what was I thinking about? Oh, yeah, suicide. You know, I mean, that's just, but once I kind of begin to realize that that's the way my mind works, it's like I just don't take it so serious anymore, you know. And I found myself gradually getting a little better, and the reason for that, for the most part, I started to try to work the steps in a way, and I wasn't getting much help, because I'm being sponsored by the group, and when you're being sponsored by the group, you don't want to ask anybody a real question, because they might think you don't know, and you got to let them know that you know, because if you don't know, they'll say, well, you should do something, and I don't want to do nothing, I just want to make you think that I know. And I made a bad mistake one time. I ended up going to Intergroup, because Intergroup wasn't answering their phone, their hotline like they should. And I knew how they should do it. And so I went over there to straighten them out, and then I come out being chairman of Intergroup. It was an accident. I didn't know it was election night. I really didn't. And I come out being the chairman of Intergroup, and the next thing you know, I got sent down to Dallas. And my wife had picked Benoit to be her sponsor, and she was going to Dallas the same week and I was. I'd met Jim and Benoit over at the Cornhusker Roundup several years earlier, and I ended up asking Jim to be my sponsor. And things changed. I mean, we started doing things that I'd never done before. You know, we started working out of the book. We started doing the steps the way the steps are supposed to be worked out of the book, as far as I'm concerned, and got actively involved. I'd already started the group, that recovery group, but Jim just added a punch to it. And the next thing you know, I mean, it came to me. I had to come to a decision. Else I was going to hang around AA or was I going to get in it? It's that simple. I'm going to have to do something here because I couldn't just hang around. I had to start doing something different. And I ended up getting that group started, and Jim began to be my sponsor, and we, just like you guys, we started shaking hands. We had greeters at the doors, and there's like other groups going, "You got greeters at the doors, you know? What are you making those new guys do? You making those new guys do things that they don't want to do, you know?" And, well, you'd ask this new guy, "Do you?" One night we had these guys. We got like 8 or 9 guys living in a house, and this. We had a district meeting, and district's main topic of conversation was these 8 or 9 guys that was living in this group house that was owned and operated by the recovery group, which is a lie. I mean, the 8 guys rented the house, you know, and the sponsors was making them do it. It's like, no, and the people that was living in the house was there that night, and they say, "No, that's not right." And there was people that saying how it really was, and here you had the people who were living in the house saying how it was, and it was just. You know, it's AA at its finest, you know. It's just insanity. And finally, what you have to do is just get to the point where you do what you know works. And it works. It works really well. I like activist AA. I love it. Because, you know, people get here and they get better. And at first, you may not feel better, but you begin to act better. And it's like getting better in every way every day. The next thing you know, Gerald's deal works. You know, and so what happened is we got that little group started, and I've always been pretty fortunate. I sponsor several guys, and got that deal going, and I sponsored a bunch more. Good to see Wayne here. You know, Wayne was a case of all of his own when he got here. He wasn't very happy after 6 years. I get a lot of guys with some time that aren't very happy coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's fantastic because what happens is the same thing that happened to me, is all of a sudden the light bulb switches on. And things begin to be an attraction, and I got to see my sponsor Richard. He caught lung cancer and died, and I was there the night he died. And Jim Shaw, he caught lung cancer and he died. And the sponsorship thing is an amazing deal. It's like Wayne said yesterday. It's not who your sponsor is so much as who you make him. And I got to see that. I'll never forget this as long as I live. Jim was living in Palm Springs, when he died, and I was lucky enough to be there the weekend that Clancy and Jim I can't think of the other guys that celebrated 30 years that year. There was a couple others. I can't think of their names. Clint Hodges was one of them. I can't think of the other. But anyway, Jim was just, I mean, he was a great big man, and all of a sudden he's, all canted up, and he's thin, and he's just weak, and sedated, and he got his little coat on, and his tie undone, and Clancy drives up outside, and Jim sees him out of the corner of his eye, and all of a sudden Jim struggles up, and he gets up, and he puts his coat on, straightens his coat on, straightens his tie up, and he walks to the door, and he says, "My sponsor's here," you know, and there's just new life, and it was because of what Jim made him, what Jim made sponsor, or what Jim made Clancy to be, and I mean, not that Clancy's not, he's something else, but it's how Jim looked at it, and I could see that, and for the next 3 or 4 days, Jim was a totally different guy. He was his old self again, and it was a blast. I mean, you know, and he told me, he says, he got me in the back room, he says, "John," he says, this is before Clancy showed up. I've been thinking. He says, "I'm not going to make it." He says, "You need to get a new sponsor." And he said, "The guy's name is," and he was heavily sedated. And he'd just go down like that. And I go, Jim, and Jim, oh yeah. He says, "I've been thinking about you, and you need to get a new sponsor. And you don't have to do this if you don't want to, but his name is." Jim, and Shaw goes, you remember his laugh? He goes, "Ha ha ha!" He goes, "Ha ha ha!" He says, "Okay," he says, "that's that guy down there in Nebraska," you know. And I went and asked Dick to be my sponsor. I'd already asked Dick to be my sponsor. I didn't have the heart to tell Jim, but Dick says, "My God, Scott, you're a carrier." He says, "I don't know if I want to ask you or I want to do it or not," but he accepted he accepted the challenge, I guess, and so he's been my sponsor now for the last 5 years, I guess, and he's helped a lot. I mean, he's been a great gift in my life. And Alcoholics Anonymous is just a phenomenal place. You know, I came here just hoping to get sober, and I found out that it's way, way more than that. And you want to be careful about your home group, because what you have here is very, very important. Because if you're an old guy like me, one of these days you're going to wake up and your daughter's going to be raising her hand for the first time as an alcoholic. And you're going to be awfully grateful that she has a place to go where recovery is happening, where there's enthusiasm, where there's activity, and where she can be fairly safe from those guys. Not that that works wonderfully around here, because we are sicker than most, but the thing is that at least you got a chance. And that's what we owe these folks that come behind us. We owe them the opportunity to recover as we have. And what we're doing is not lightly taken. It is absolutely paramount for people of alcohol, people who have alcoholism, because without this, there's not a shot. I mean, they've tried everything for thousands of years, and nothing works for us. And this is not that good, but by golly, at least it worked for nut like me, a fruitcake like Wayne. Wayne and I can make it. Anybody can make it, you know. And there's a few of you here that you know. You know what? What a gift we have here. This thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to talk to you a little bit about the allergy of alcoholism. And if you're new here, maybe this will make sense to you, because I had a hard time with allergy. I mean, even though I was allergic to apples, bananas, and cherries, and still am, I couldn't get it through my head about the allergy. And about social drinking, and about how that works and plays into this part. And if you read the doctor's opinion in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, he does a really good job of explaining it. And what I found out is that there's a big difference between my problem that I have with alcohol and the problem that I have with apples. And that is that I have never ever gone home mad and angry and upset and decided that I was going to go and buy myself about 6 apples. And when I get those 6 apples, I'm going to hide 2 in the trunk. I'm going to eat 2 on the way home. And when I get home, I'm going to eat 2 of them right in front of her. I just never have done that. That has never occurred to me. You know, I have never had. You know, whenever I went to my doctor with this problem that I have with apples, and I said, you know, look, here's what's happening. The newest person in this room can tell me exactly what the doctor said. Don't do it anymore. You know, I didn't even have to go to AA, Apples Anonymous. I didn't have to do that. All I did was I quit. I just quit. I have never woke up in the middle of the night thinking, my God, I need an apple. I have never sat there at supper and I've looked across the table and saw people with fruit salad going with a tear in my eye. I could have had some of that if I wasn't allergic to apples. I have never done that. You know, it never even crosses my mind. But with alcohol, it's a totally different story, ain't it? I sit there and I look across the room and I see those people over there drinking that wine. And I go, oh, you know, I mean, just, oh, you know. I could have some of that if I wasn't an alcoholic, you know, and I'd sit there and I'd look at those people and I'd just get, you know, wave after wave after wave of self-pity comes over me. And I kind of like self-pity a little bit at first, you know. And what I found out was that if I think just a little bit, if I use my head just a little bit, I hate wine. I always hated wine. You know, my deal is give me some whiskey. Give me some good whiskey, you know, and 2 at a time and keep them coming, please. And why would you have a sip of wine? Why would you want to have a sip of wine or 2 sips or a glass or 2 glasses? I had friends that had 4 or 5 beers in the refrigerator and I would not go to their house because that's all they had. You know, why would you bother with 2 or 3 beers? See, I'm an alcoholic of a hopeless variety. I'm a guy who once I start to drink, I cannot quit. And when I start drinking, I run everybody away from me just as hard and as fast as I can. I can't hold a job. I can't hold a family. I can't love kids. I hated my kids when I was drinking. I couldn't stand them. I told you I loved them. I tried to act like I loved them, but if you was looking at me from the outside, you would know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I didn't love them, because my actions showed everybody that I absolutely despised them, because they were slowing me down. just like she was slowing me down, just like my work was slowing me down. And if you was a friend of mine and you couldn't keep up, you were slowing me down. And I didn't have no friends. Why would you, you know, I just didn't have friends. I had people that I drank with. That's what I had. And, you know, and I'll sit there with a tear in my eye and look over there and see those people having that wine. And I think, my God, why can't I have a drink of wine? And I have to think past that. I have to think on. You know, I have to think on past that first drink and see where it takes me, because I know where it's going to take me. It's taking me to the same place it's always going to take me. I was telling somebody right before the meeting got started, my old sponsor, Richard, used to say, let's just stay in here and be real stupid. Let's stay in here and be real stupid. We'll let them smart guys go out there into that research and development department of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we'll see how they come back. And they always, you know, it's like we say in our home group, our scouts always come back with arrows in their butts, you know. So I imagine your scouts are probably the same way. A few of you have scouted yourself. But the thing is that this has been an absolute phenomenal gift to me and my family and the people around me. My mom is, my family, my immediate family, my mom and my dad have always supported me in Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom, one time, she says, I am so thankful that you quit drinking. And I said, well, she said, do you remember the time that I drove up to the mailbox? Because I didn't answer the mail. I don't know if, when you was new, if you answered the mail too well. I just hated mail because they was always wanting money, you know. And I didn't want to answer the phone and I didn't want to answer the door. But my mailbox was down the road in front of my mom's house. So I'd have to drive down there to get this mail. And so I went down there one time after I'd been gone for about a week, and Cindy had been gone for about a month, I think. And we were not going to the same places, we were different places. And I said, Mom, I said, I don't know, somebody broke into my house and they stole all my guns. And she says, well, my dad, or your dad and I have taken all your guns. And I said, well, why? She said, well, we're afraid that you're going to kill somebody. I said, Mom, if I'm going to kill somebody, this is what I'm going to do. It's right here. You know, and I could just remember that look of despair over her face and just, you know. And they tried so hard to do something for me, but they didn't know what to do. They didn't know what was going on. They thought I was crazy. I was hoping I was crazy. If I'm insane, I can go to the nut house for a while. They'll give me some downers or uppers or whatever they give you that makes you feel good for the, you know, for the next couple of days. And after I get out of that place, I can drink. But if I'm an alcoholic, and I admit that I'm a real alcoholic of the hopeless variety, then I have a solution in my life, and I don't want that solution, because the solution is you don't drink. And if you want to stay sober and enjoy life, then not only do you not drink, but you go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I finally, through years of resistance, I finally got to the place where I found out it's always better for me to go to meetings, because tomorrow I'm going to feel just a little bit better. Just the opposite of drinking. Whenever I was drinking, I knew that tomorrow was just going to be a little bit worse. Now when I go to AA every night, I know that tomorrow's going to be a little bit better. I found myself here in January. I had a bad motorcycle wreck a couple of years ago. I was running some cattle and just wiped out, dang near killed myself. And ever since then, about every 6 months, I get this physical and trying to piece me back together again. And in January, we found that I had cancer. And that'll get your attention, I'll tell you what. Right now, you know, you think you're living in a... You're thinking you're living one day at a time. Try that on for size. You know, with a mind like me, you know, the guy says, bring your wife. So I brought my wife. I knew it was bad when he says bring your wife. You know, they don't say bring your wife, it's good. You know, and so I brought my wife and we sat down there. And what I heard him say was that you're dying of cancer and you're probably not going to make it more than about 45 minutes. That's what I heard. I mean, I walked home, I went down and got in the car and I said, well, I guess I'm not long for this life. And she says, what? I said, well, I'm dying. I got cancer. I'm dying. And she says, that's not what he said. He said, you'd probably be all right if we do this and this and this. And I'm, well, he was just giving it a little at a time, you know, or whatever. But anyway, we had it in February. I had an operation, and I'm just now getting over it. And I'm amazed that I was able to talk this long without having to run to the bathroom, and because my plumbing ain't quite right yet. But it's probably more than most of you really wanted to know. But you know, the thing was that I had letters and cards and calls from one end of this country to the other. I mean, I really did. It was amazing. I mean, it's absolutely, truly amazing. I had Cindy sponsors a bunch of them sick alley 99s, and they were bringing me food every day to make sure I didn't get up. You know, they was afraid I'd lose weight. I just got fatter, and they just treated me right. And the people that I sponsor, they come by and give me meetings, and they took me around to different places when I couldn't drive. That's cool stuff. That's cool stuff. My sponsor called me every day. That was different, and wanted to know how I was doing. And I mean, he just choked me up when he do that. My kids want to know how I was doing. My wife was there loving me. My mom and dad come up from Texas, and they took care of me. My wife is working for H&R Block. I picked a great time to go down, and it's just wave after wave of gifts from you guys, gifts from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is from a guy who can't hold a job, who hates his wife and kids, who can't stand his wife, who wants to get rid of her family, just absolutely just drove them to the edge of the earth, and I didn't have any friends. I mean, this is who I am now. Now, you can call it anything you want to, but I'm going to call it the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because in here, if you stay here and you do what the book asks us to do, and you simulate some kind of interest for a period of time, all of a sudden one day some goofy newcomer will come up to you and ask you if you can be their sponsor. And if you're like me, the first 15 I sponsored, I killed them all. They all went out and got drunk in rapid succession. And finally, well, I was going to be kind. I wasn't going to be cruel like my sponsor. I was going to, try to help them do the four step and all that stuff. And finally, this guy comes up and asks me to be a sponsor, and I told him no. I told him no. Now, my sponsor, Richard, had already been gone. And all I could hear in my head was the answer to an AA request is always yes, and I knew it was a yes. And I walked out the door, and I turned around right back here, and I said, yeah, I'll be your sponsor, but by God, these are the things you're going to do. Blah, 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 blah. He says, okay. And he's still sober today. Now, I don't know. I try to run them off, and they stay sober. And I try to love them, and they go get drunk or something. I don't know what the heck. It's a crazy place, this thing we're in, this Alcoholics Anonymous. And it needs to be, because look at who's around. Look at who you're sitting next to, if you don't think that. There's some great gifts that we have here, and I think the biggest gift that we have is the message that we get, and we need to share the message. We need to give it as fast and as hard as anybody will take it. The young ones, it's good to see all the young people here, because I tell you what, when I was about, I wasn't even as young as most of you guys. I still drink it, but whenever I was in my 30s, I mean, I would take this message of Alcoholics Anonymous as I interpreted Gospel according to John, and I'd sit there and say, this is what's supposed to be going on. And I just kind of spoon feed it to them, until their eyes roll around in their head, and they finally, okay, I got it, just anything to shut me up. But to finally get to the place where you find out that you don't know is a great place to be. To find out that I can live, I can truly live one day at a time. To be in the here and the now is a special place to be. I was always so intimidated by my past about how it should have been, about the guilt and self-pity and remorse that seems to hang back there. And then I'd go back there for a while, and then I'd live in the future about how I'm going to go broke tomorrow, how she's going to leave me tomorrow, how those kids are going to be tomorrow. And you don't have much relief at either of those places, in the past or the future, either one of them, because God doesn't live in either one of those. But where God lives is right here, right now. He's right here, right now. And if I can bring my head, like my sponsor used to say, bring my head where my butt is in the right here and the right now. And if I can bring my head where my butt is, all of a sudden I'm in God's time. And when I'm in God's time, there's nothing that can go wrong. There's nothing that can go wrong. It's as good as it gets. And that's one of the things, that's the biggest gift that I've ever received here, is being able to live one day at a time, being able to be in the here and the now, especially in the last several months. I mean, it's been absolutely critical for me to live in the here and the now. And I just want to tell you guys, thank you again for letting me be a part of your deal. It's an absolutely phenomenal thing that's happening here, and it's fragile. And don't think it's not, because all you got to do is quit doing what you're doing. And if you've got a mind like mine, it'll convince you that this is the wrong thing to be doing. My sister, one time, I'm going to tell you one more story, and I'm going to shut up. My sister had a store a few years ago, if you don't think this thinking is fragile. And she asked me to help her run it, or I volunteered, I can't remember which. It's hard to tell. And the store was kind of going bad, you know, it was going downhill. When I got a hold of it, it went downhill, like that. And I was sponsoring this guy, and he was a rich guy, he had lots of money. And he would spend his winters in Central America and had a little place down there. I always had my hand, you know, I'm going to sponsor the guy and he'll take me down there for winter vacation. And I sponsored him for about 3 weeks, and he called me up one day and says, you know, I'm not going to do what you do anymore because you guys are overcorrecting. You're doing too much. And he was a heck of a salesman. And he started explaining to me in a way that I could even hear about how we were doing too much here. And I kind of got to, and I hung up the phone, and I got to thinking about it. It just rolled around in my head all day long like it will, you know. And I had told my sister, after that, I talked to her, and I told her, I says, I'll tell you what, I'll pick you up for lunch today, and I'll take you out, because she was depressed. I mean, she was depressed. She's not one of us. She was really depressed. She wasn't one of those, you know, we get depressed, so we, you know, give me something for it. So I feel better. And she was absolutely over the top. I mean, she was lifeless, and she hadn't laughed in days and weeks and months, and I picked her up and I took her out, and I said, you know, Maggie, I was talking to this guy this morning, and he just made so much sense, and I think the truth of the matter is I really wasn't that bad. You know, I don't think I drank that bad. If anybody went through the stuff that I went through during that period of time, they'd acted probably like I acted. And right there at the end, I said, I just kind of got, you know, I was weak, and they got a hold of me and made me go into AA, you know. And she started laughing. She hadn't laughed in months, and she started laughing. She got laughing so hard, she started yelling at me to get to the filling station so she can run in the bathroom, you know. And she's just down. I mean, she's just down laughing, and I can't figure out what's wrong. And she goes in there, and she comes back out, and she's still laughing. And finally, she comes down and says, what in the hell is wrong with you? And she says, you don't remember, do you? You are a crazy SOB. You're just crazier than I thought you was, aren't you? I said, what are you talking about? She says, you don't remember, do you? Every single day for the last 4 years, you drank, and you drank as much as anybody. We were so afraid that you was going to kill somebody or kill yourself. And you said, and you don't think you was that bad? My God, what does it take? And I guess I'll go to a meeting tonight, you know. I mean, you know, and if you're here for a few years, that took place at 11 years of sobriety for me. So, you know, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. Sometimes not at all, I guess. But the truth of the matter is there's no place I'd rather be. And I'm just excited to see this happening like it is here. And I want to thank you guys again. Thank you very much.